Local support for Free Speech Radio News was provided by our members. Also by Zeebo at the Elk Cove Inn and Spa, featuring organic seasonal cuisine. Reservations at 877-3321. This is listener-supported community radio, KZYX 90.7 FM, Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM, Willits and Ukiah, also 88.3 in Fort Bragg, and on the web at kzyx.org. Stay tuned in just a moment for a brand new show debuting this evening here on KZYX and Z, Education Now, with the team of Melville.
Francis Moore-Lapay, author of Diet for a Small Planet and Democracy's Edge, Choosing to Save Our Country by Bringing Democracy to Life, is coming to the Fort Bragg Town Hall, Friday, March 17th, 7 p.m. It's a benefit for KZYX and the Alliance for Democracy. Sliding scale, $10 to $20. Nobody turned away. That's Francis Moore-Lapay, Fort Bragg Town Hall, March 17th, 7 p.m.
Democracy is coming. You who are on the road must have a code that you can live by. And so, become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by. And teach them on your dreams, the one they fix, the one you know by. Don't you ever let them lie, if they told you you would try, to just look at them and cry. And you know they love you.
It's 7 o'clock and time for Education Now. Education Now is being brought to you tonight by our members and Fabric Indulgence and Art Supply, providing Northern California communities with fine art supplies, clay, paper arts, beads, mosaic supplies, and fabrics, located at 544 South Main Street in Fort Bragg and Fort Bragg and fabricandart.com. Well, my name is Athena Melville, and tonight my guest on Education Now is Dr. William Crane, professor of psychology at the City College of New York and author of the classic Theories of Development. Theories of Development is a synthesis of great minds in human development. In Bill's new book, Reclaiming Childhood, he illustrates the need to allow children to be children in this achievement-oriented society. He and more than 60 high-profile figures in child development, psychology, pediatrics, and mental health issued a statement challenging state and federal policies toward early childhood education that places overwhelming emphasis on academic skills. Hello, Bill. Are you there? Hello, Bill? Hello, Bill. I can't hear you. Well, we're having some technical problem here. Mary's working on it. Hello, Bill, are you here? Are you here? I still can't hear you, Bill. So we're going to try and figure out what's going on. I've got two engineers in here, Mary Eigner and Burton Siegel, both trying. Hello, Bill?
Yes.
You're there. Bill, could you speak up again so we can get your levels?
Sure, I'm right here.
Oh, thank you so very much for joining us, Bill. I know it's late there in New York, and I want to thank your family for sharing you with us tonight.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I wanted the audience that's listening to get an idea about your life. I know that you have three grown children.
Right.
And a wife named Ellen, who is very supportive of your work.
Right.
and that you have a brother named Steve who helped you with your work with Chomsky on linguistics. He's in linguistics. Is that correct?
Yes, he's a real devotee of Chomsky, a major researcher, my younger brother, Stephen.
Oh, that's beautiful. And what about your life, graduate school and your interests when you were a child? Did you follow your bliss? Did you follow your joy?
I did. I grew up in Southern California, and I became very interested in college. I went to Harvard back east, and then became interested in child development there, and studied at the University of Chicago human development, clinical psychology, and those were, you know, very important years. And then when I came to New York, I began teaching at the City College of New York and raising our children, and they had a major influence, really an inspiration, raising kids, brought it all home, and started to appreciate the wonders of childhood, and also the forces that were making it hard for children to be children. That started to, and that was not so joyful to see the pressures, the intense pressures on kids to, as the our leaders kept putting it, to get ready, get children prepared for the competitive global workplace of the future, and bringing academics down to younger and younger ages, and more intense pressures, and it was that's sort of when I got started getting into these battles to try to preserve the joys of childhood, and which have occupied me for the rest of my life ever since our kids were little in the 70s.
Yes, I know exactly where you're coming from. I, too, was so committed to seeing that my children, I could follow their bliss and follow their interests, and found that that was very difficult, that California had broken its promise to the children of this state. When I moved here, education was free, college was free, and open to everyone, and so I just decided I had to do it myself, and that's when I ran into Joy Turner, and she introduced me to your amazing book, Series of Development, which just answered, it was like an answer to me, because it verified all of my hunches, and then I used it as a teacher with my high school students, and of course it was following their own interests, and they just loved the book so much, Bill.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Oh, yeah. And so I can't thank you. I can't thank you enough. And I've just been getting into the fifth edition, which is exciting. And but really, the work that you're doing with the Alliance, I think, is so critical. And I'm so grateful to you and others who are speaking out, because it's just so critical for children. And now that mine are raised, I feel like I have an opportunity to help empower parents.
Yes, it's that's great, and the work you've done with your school is wonderful. The Alliance, I think it's very important, this school. We're trying to preserve play, I guess the main focus is play is now, there's no time for it in the kindergartens. Even kindergartens have homework, and now it's putting academics down into preschool, and they're testing them, and
right.
Pretty soon they'll have you know, the babies have to get ready for the rigors of preschool.
Right.
Everything is getting ready for some rigorous future, and there's no time for the children to develop their own strengths, and they absolutely must have time to play. If they don't, they won't have to develop their imaginations or symbolic capacities. It's just incredible, and they don't have time to explore nature, which has been a major focus of mine, is the child's need for contact with the natural world.
That's what's so beautiful about Reclaiming Childhood. You really lay it out clearly. I mean, it's something that I knew, but I just always, I want to give it to everyone.
Oh, that's good. Joy Turner, by the way, was a big supporter. I mean, she added inspiration and support at various critical times, especially she asked me to write essays on the child's tied to the natural world. And actually, once when I was... when I was in the 80s, I felt that the crisis was so great that I ran for the school board in Teaneck, New Jersey, where we lived.
Right.
And I lost the first election and served 9 years. But during that time, I saw, you know, children need contact with the natural world, but all around us, there were up went malls and parking lots, and we started to cut down some pine trees in my town. I stood in front of a truck and got arrested, and I felt very alone in that, because back then that wasn't done that often, and I did it by myself. And Joy, I talked to her about it, you know, and she said, well, why don't you write an essay on this for Montessori Life, which she edited. And that was the kind of thing she did that was helpful. My gosh, if Montessori Life wants me to write about this, and maybe it wasn't such a weird thing to do after all.
No, what's so amazing for me, the value of play, you know, the higher mammals play, dolphins play.
Oh, yeah.
It's so essential to intelligence, and I noticed that was a subject that you covered at the Alliance. Or you were discussing children and intelligence. And I don't think people really realize that. They think that when you say children need to play, that you're just being a softy or you don't have limits. It's so difficult for them to realize that what you're saying is that they are actually developing their intelligence by playing.
Right. It's the first use of symbols, I think, in the age of around two comes through play. When the child says this, has a stick, you know, makes a stick walk in the sand and says horse. Horsey or something. The stick is symbolizing a horse, and we all know that humans have this capacity to use symbols, which is so important. But it emerges through play, and their imaginations and their creativity develop through play. The kids now they're getting the survey we did with the Alliance, a pilot survey with kindergarten teachers. Some have been teaching for 10 or 11 years said that they've seen a dramatic decrease in play, but the kids don't even, at 5 to 6, don't even know how to play. When they go outdoors, they don't know what to do. What this is doing to kids, this play deprivation, what it's doing to the kids,
right,
is probably very serious.
I heard about a new theory of behavior nature deficiency disorder.
Right.
NDD, nature deficiency disorder. And I thought, well, if you have to put a label to it, yes, you know, isn't that the truth? I know that living here in a beautiful piece of nature and seeing that it's threatened and how the wild is threatened and realizing that children, you know, they don't get to play in the mud. And
yeah.
And Montessori, she was talking about how great peasants had it in her day.
Right. Montessori wrote beautiful things about the child's need for the natural world way back in the early 1900s. I went through and found some of very fine writing by her. For an early issue of the Montessori Life magazine, 1997, and I've updated that more recently for an encyclopedia, and also in my book Reclaiming Childhood. But the natural world does so much for them. It develops their powers of patient observation. If people remember how themselves, or when they were little, or watching kids, they have a chance to how patiently they will watch things like birds, or listen to the wind, or look at insects, and look at plants and taste them and feel them, and so their powers of observation are very important, and they also are very creative in natural settings. They build things, they build forts and hideouts, and they build little model towns in the sand.
Yes, they do.
And I went through a lot of their volumes of poetry and found that two-thirds to three-quarters of the poems in the anthologies I had available, two-thirds to three-quarters were about the natural world of children's poems, so it definitely inspired their poetry and their artwork. And it gives them a sense of being part of something larger than themselves, you know, part of part of the larger web of life, a kind of feeling of belonging in the world that is very important to the sense of connection or oneness of the world. It stabilizes them and gives them some feeling that they're rooted in something larger than themselves, something good. They don't feel, I think, when children get that, they don't feel so shaky or alone. They feel an inner sense of peace and belonging that is very important for their mental health. Nowadays, you know, people go around saying that they're trying to find inner peace. They don't know where to find it, and they look to yoga and meditation and other things, which is, those things are fine, but I think if the kids, it's going to be increasingly a problem. If kids can have more contact with the natural world, they'll have this inner calm and connection with the world.
I couldn't agree with you more. I couldn't agree. And if you observe, if you have an opportunity to observe children in a natural setting, participating like that, then there isn't any question in your mind how beneficial it is for them. But it is difficult to get people to understand it, although you see that people who have been around, children who have been raised in an environment where they're around animals and dirt, don't have the allergies that other children do. They don't have the fears of life that other children do. They don't have such a hard time accepting that life feeds on life.
Yes. It's very hard to get parents to understand this, and teachers also, that, what they think, what good does it do for my child to play in the mud? That's not increasing her vocabulary. That's not going to help her with the SATs. it's not going to help her get into Yale and so on. In a way, it's true. The child will be feel better about herself and have a happier childhood right now and be a more fulfilled person. It's for their overall development, they need these experiences, like you say, the general feelings about life. It's a hard one because I think in the end they will probably do just as well if they can have these experiences.
Oh, I know they do. I've experienced it as a teacher. I've experienced that children who, I know, for instance, if Einstein had been tested the way that they're doing now, he would have been labeled a failure. These pressures, these not following the child's interest.
Right.
It's so empowering to a child when you follow their interest and when they teach you something. I remember that I didn't know how to tell a male spider from a female spider, and a student wanted to do his research on spiders, and I said, of course. And so he was explaining to me that male spiders have little balls at the ends of their feelers, and I was just astounded.
Yeah.
They teach you. The children teach you things. And
yes. Ironically, you can introduce an awful lot of academic work through nature studies. And certainly biology and the scientific attitude. Which is basically really is an exploratory attitude and a curiosity that you want to nurture. That's more important than anything else, and it's a shame we have these ideas of what kids should be doing, and you know the skills, and we set these standards, and we think we know everything there is about development just by thinking it up ourselves. We don't follow the child and give them a chance to move in directions that are most meaningful to them. When we don't do that, we end up stifling their curiosity and enthusiasm, and we don't.
And denying that they have an inner self.
They do have an inner self. They have a need to develop different capacities at different ages, different stages. Those don't always correspond to what we want. There's a tremendous adult arrogance the way we approach children.
I was reading Schumacher a little bit, and he was saying that he was sitting at a table in a restaurant with a family of three across from him, and the little boy said to the waitress that he would like liver and onions. And the father said, we'll take three steaks. And the waitress said, two steaks and one liver and onions. And the little boy turned to the parents and said, she thinks I'm real.
That's another part of it. If if you don't give the children the opportunities that, like, say, with drawing, which is another, you know, the arts are also stifled in the current.
Yes, that was the first thing they cut out in California after Prop 13, was the arts.
And children, young children especially, they develop remarkable powers. Their art is, go through this period where it's just flowers and what Howard Gardner called the golden period. And they don't have, they don't give them any time. They may still draw when they get a chance, but they don't have a chance to really let it flourish. And like the example you give in the restaurant, what's it mean to a child when adults don't affirm what's so vital and creative within the child, when they feel it means nothing to the adult world, what the impulses, the creative impulses that are so important from within? It's they just it must feel like adults are strange and don't value them at all.
Yes, I think Picasso was aghast that people didn't value the art of children.
Yeah.
And so he started painting like a child, selling for, you know, all these hundreds of thousands of dollars, and he just thought it was hysterical.
Yeah.
That they didn't value their own children's art, yet they were paying all of this money. That was inspirational to me too. That made.
Yeah, there are Klee, Picasso, Kandinsky, many certainly the modern masters and some others said that what they really want to do is recapture the attitudes, the artistic attitudes they had as a young child. Or Picasso's famous line was, "Once I could draw like Raphael." What he meant was that when he was about 12 or 13, he could already paint like the master Raphael, realistically.
Mm-hmm.
But it, they said, he went on to say, "But it took me a lifetime, or it had taken me a lifetime to learn to paint like a child." Child's art was his inspiration, and even their adults, when I've watched how they teach, they correct the young child's drawing, and they try to get him to draw in ways that are more realistic. And adults have trouble just appreciating children. They can't sit back. I mean, it would be pretty obvious that every child between about 5 and 7 starts drawing these beautifully fresh, well, harmonious figures and drawings. They're just wonderful. And yet we don't appreciate it. If we could just, I think if we just appreciate our children more, they would, you would see their confidence and their enthusiasm and their feeling about moving forward and taking risks, and their boldness and their sense, inner strength would develop in a way that we would be very proud of.
I agree. Buckminster Fuller said, "I wasn't born a genius. I was just less damaged than other children."
Uh-huh.
And
a nice statement.
Yes, I've always felt that was the truth, that every child is a genius, and every child is as unique as every snowflake. And
yes.
It's just that when they're treated like some statistic, I know Jung said about statistics, you know, they tell you this average pebble is about the size of your thumbnail. Now, you go find that average pebble on the beach, and you won't find it, because it just doesn't exist except in your mind. The average is in your mind. It's all unique, every pebble and every child.
Right, which our standardized tests ignore.
Totally ignore.
Yeah, it's just treats them into statistics, and
yes.
It does more than that. In New York City right now, the enthusiasm, everybody knows that their babies are curious and exploring the world, and children in their play and their explorations are boldly curious, and school generally has put a damper on that curiosity and that enthusiasm to learn, which is a driving force behind intellectual development. But now with these tests, the kids are scared. They live their school life in this high-stress, fearful environment, and we replaced enthusiasm with dread. It's getting close to the kind of child abuse where the kids are scared of being left back, they're scared of not doing well, they can't stand the school, they're either bored or scared.
I would agree with you, especially since school, from the Greek, spoleo,
mm-hmm.
means leisure or pleasure or joy. So you're supposed to have joy in
uh-huh.
learning. And that joy in the learning, you know, how can you even call it school at this point?
It's the, right, the purpose of education was initially to draw out the talent, or lead out the talents or something.
Right, that's education.
People don't care.
Of course, implies that there is something inner.
Yes.
Which many people have a problem with, you know. Rousseau's idea that, you know,
yeah,
there is something inner.
There's an inner force that prompts kids to learn different, reach out to different kinds of experiences.
Right, and they don't think that's scientific.
Yeah, it's everyday observation.
Yeah. How about Chomsky? Can you talk to us about, our audience is pretty familiar with him in terms of radical politics.
Yes.
And some people in terms of his linguistics, but I don't think a lot of people really realize his contribution in the field of human development.
Yes. Chomsky is very difficult, I think he's the main spokesman from the left in terms of foreign policy,
uh-huh,
as you say, and they know he has a theory of linguistics, and it's, I've, even with my brother's help, butted my head against it and spent months trying to figure out what he's saying and get it straight. But essentially, for psychology and developmental psychology, he does have a very powerful message, which is that children spontaneously master syntax, a grammar for performing correct sentences, and they do it. With no formal teaching, they do it on their own, and between the ages of, from birth of 2 to about 6, they've mastered this syntax, which is incredibly abstract and deep. It's deeply buried within the language. It's not marked, or the rules are not marked, but somehow they figure them out. And if an immigrant child comes over to, say, from the United States, from South America or some other country, she'll pick up English off the streets with no formal education, just off the streets or the playground from other kids, very rapidly, whereas adults struggle. And what they're doing is so amazing and so difficult. It's as if they were, performing advanced calculus.
Yeah.
At the age of 5, writing it all out is something. It's even harder than that. And so there's something just incredible that they're able to do.
Right.
And they do it on their own. And so the message is that people don't really believe, like you say, that kids have this creative power, that we have to take control and teach them. But here you have a very clear example of their creative power.
Right.
And our kids do it. Kids from lower, kids from the ghettos, kids from the rich districts, kids that don't score very high on IQ tests, kids that score high. They're all linguistic geniuses.
Right.
Every kid is a linguistic genius. There's no other way of putting it. As
right.
You say, every kid's a genius. And then all we do is try to find differences among the kids.
Right.
And they're trivial. We find differences in vocabulary, and their vocabulary development is amazing, but it's nothing like the acquisition of syntax or
right.
grammar, and yet so not, we can measure it and compare kids, so parents are now get caught up, they get sucked into this competition to increase their kids' vocabularies, when it's really a minor development compared to syntax. And then we start comparing. We call these kids inferior. They have too low a vocabulary. And how can we help them? And we end up focusing on their deficiency and ignoring the fact that the kids, say, from a low-income family who hasn't had much talk in his environment, nevertheless, his capacity for syntax is so phenomenal that we should just sit back and admire that.
Right.
And there's no reason for him to feel inferior. I mean, that's the social construction. So the lesson is there's some tremendous creative power here.
Yeah, and it's such a to discount the self-concept of the child. There's
yes.
such damage to that creative power.
Yes, it is.
It buries it.
It is. Montessori actually was one of the she's been a major inspiration, and there, among others to me. She was one of the first to see this.
Right, she intuited it.
Yeah, she intuited it.
She intuited it, and then Chomsky proved it.
Yeah, Chomsky proved it. I think I was able to point that out early in the series of development book. That she,
yes, she did.
She caught that in very moving terms. She was very intuitive. She had a sense of that there was something almost mystical power in the child's ability to absorb the... That's part of the absorbent mind, she calls
right.
it. She'll pull in this something, and pull it in with all her might. As if,
like little sponges.
Yeah, as if they were like being at a concert where we're deeply moved and we're listening to the music. And if we could imagine intensifying that by 100 times, that's how the child is pulling in this grammar. And there's some unique capacity to pull it in and make it her own, the child's own. It's just it's incredible, but it should be an inspiration that the child can do that also in the art and with the arts, and they can do that. They feel something, connections, and with the natural world. The way they look at things, they're pulling stuff in from the natural world and forming themselves and their powers. And yet we deny them opportunities to do all these things rather than watching what they most deeply concentrate on.
Right.
Rather than following their deepest interests.
Than following them.
Yeah, it's, if we could, because like you say, there's some force we don't understand that prompts them to move in these different directions. And
right.
For a while, it's not academics, really.
No.
Yeah, we insist that they learn academics because we value academics as adults. But what we end up doing is we get them to learn to work on things that don't feel natural to them, and we don't give them a chance to develop their own strengths, and we're really crippling their growth. And we're surprised when there's all kinds of acting out and unhappiness. Our kids seem lethargic
and violent.
Violent and unhappy, you know,
and boredom.
Yeah, bored. They don't see themselves ever.
Right.
Well, they're not themselves. They're not happy and peaceful and pleasant because they haven't had. They're not fulfilled. They haven't had a chance to fulfill their potential. So,
right.
These are some of the battles. It's to try to get people to appreciate more. I think they can. People relax and watch children. They start to become impressed.
Right.
Well, have you had experience trying to get people to appreciate children's powers more?
I have had experience with that, and my goals have been to empower parents, and parents at our school always were given the option to teach a subject and pass on what they knew to children as a way of empowering them, so that. If the parent had a bad self-concept, well, if the parent did, then the child would. And so it really is empowering the whole family to appreciate the process. You know, we need to take a music break, and when we come back, I want to talk about Rhoda Kellogg, and I want to talk about this more process-oriented education rather than the product-oriented, which is where this testing is going.
Yes.
So we'll take about a 2-minute music break.
Okay.
Does that sound all right?
Yeah.
Be back then.
Your children are not your children. They are the sons and the daughters of light, longing for itself. They come to you, but they are not from you. And though they are with you, they belong not to you. You can give them your love, but not your thoughts. They have their own thoughts. They have their own thoughts. You can house their bodies, but not their souls. For their souls dwell in a place of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You can try to be like them, but you cannot make them just like you. Try to be like them, but you cannot make them just like you. Your children are not your children.
They are the sons and the daughters of a life longing for itself. They come to you, but they are not from you. And though they are with you, they belong not to you. You can give in your love, but not your fault. They have their own thoughts. They have their own thoughts. You can have their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in a place of tomorrow. But you cannot give it now, even in your dreams. You can try to be like them, but you cannot make them just like you. Try to be like them, but you cannot make them just like you.
Hello, Bill. Are you there?
Yes.
All right. I want to let our listening audience know this is KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Community Public Radio, and we're talking with Dr. William Crane, Professor of Psychology at the City College of New York, author of Theories of Development and his latest book, Reclaiming Childhood. So welcome back, Bill. And before we go on to Rhoda Kellogg and her amazing book about art, I wanted to go back to Joy, because we were talking about Joy. You and I know Joy. She was my mentor and your friend, and we used your book in all of her in her class. And then later on, people who Joy's just an amazing person. Anybody who's interested can just Google her on the web. She died last July, and I'm dedicating this show to her. When I met Joy, she was doing the philosophy of education, and I had just decided that I had to homeschool my kids because, you know, education was going down the tubes in California, and I couldn't afford private school. And so I took this class. I did my training with Joy, and second time I met Joy, and I was just enthralled with this book and everything she told me, she was wearing a necklace which exactly matched the earrings that I was wearing. And they were one of a kind. And I took that as a message, like Jung, you know, from the universe saying that I had ears to hear what she was going to say. And certainly I did. And she visited our school several times. She did a speech on children in the future for Mendocino College here when she came to visit, and just a remarkable woman who understood children and really loved them. And I know that she's going to be so happy that you're on the air tonight, Bill.
Well, thank you. She was very special.
Right.
You know, I think a lot of people felt this kind of connection with her.
Yes.
That there was a wisdom that she had about children and their perspective.
Yeah.
That the song you played at intermission was wonderful too.
Oh, that Sweet Honey in the Rock.
Yeah.
You liked it.
Yeah, that was great. Joy was she was very supportive in a lot of ways. I see, with me it's things are a little quickier, you know, that I thought were more offbeat that she picked up, which I appreciated. I wrote this essay on the Peanuts cartoons and the character Peppermint Patty in there, which struck me as a beautiful rendition of a natural child. Peppermint Patty was failing in school. She was always getting D minuses, and yet she was respected by the other kids, and was a lively, real, natural, strong child. And it indicates there's something that strengths in children that schools don't always nurture or don't always even touch. And she was helpful, was a gracious, outgoing child and tomboy. And, I was moved by that, and I sent it to. I didn't know what to do with it. The essay, and I sent it off to Joy, and she just put it in the magazine right away.
Yeah.
So is that kind of thing. You know, you take a chance on something.
Well, I noted that you're an editor of a magazine as well.
Yes, I've Encounter, called Encounter, Education for Meaning and Social Justice. This is a, we're trying to publish writings and essays that try to maintain some vision of education that inspires the growth of the whole child, and not just the academic, the intellectual.
If people were interested in this magazine, how could they connect? How could they?
Well, I guess one quick way is to email me, which is Bill Crain, B-I-L-L-C-R-A-I-N, all one word, at AOL.com. That email's pretty easy to remember.
Right.
Or they can I think you can call up on a website, Encounter: Education for Meaning and Social Justice. The social justice part has also been important to me, and we need more articles on things, writings. Also, I could use things. If listeners have written something, they could also send things to me, and I think they'll like the journal. At the City University, I've spent a lot of years trying to keep the admissions open to low-income students and people of color who
have not had a chance.
And it seems like a lot of my life has been battles, but that's, I guess, the way it goes. But we've sort of been losing that one recently, mostly through testing. The whole educational system is obsessed with tests, and at the college level, and maybe earlier, they use it to keep people out and to deprive them of opportunities that were hard won. Open admissions was difficult, hard won civil rights battle, which allowed open the doors of our university to people of color, really. That's been taken away by imposing all these tests, which seem to me very biased and don't predict success in college, and yet they end up turning away students of color.
Yes, I have research that proves that the most effective, the document that tells you the most about how the child will do in life and in school is the teacher's recommendation. Mm-hmm. But they all think that's way too subjective.
Yes. That's the problem, that tests have numbers attached to them.
Right, right. Even though there's proof for that in the research, still get this business about the test.
It's incredible how we've gone astray here. It's the mindset of the whole culture, which is if you can quantify something, then it's meaningful. If you can't, it defies common sense.
It defies common sense. That seems to be running rampant in our country. Does it defy competition?
It does. It really does. I was on the school board, and I was arguing with the state that you can't just put everything that's quantifiable. Like, some teachers in physical education wanted to have a standard that they called sportsmanship. It sounded okay. It's a pretty good standard to have, but the state wouldn't allow it because there's no way of quantifying it. They tried to come up with things like number of handshakes you give to an opponent after a game or something. But it was the number of times you say good game. But, it didn't work. So they dropped it. So there's no standard for sportsmanship. The things that really that really matter, which are the creativity of the child. That's very hard to quantify, or their capacity for concentration, or their enthusiasm. This is very hard to quantify. Yet these are what drives them. This is the process. This is what drives intellectual development. I think all of us know. We can remember back when we got engaged in something, and we threw ourselves into it, and how meaningful that was. And then now those are the times when the mind develops. It's when we get engrossed in something we think creatively and imaginatively and deeply, and those are the occasions when our minds expand. It's not by memorizing drills and answers and formulas that'll get us high scores on tests. It doesn't do anything for our intellectual development. And so we could develop a nation of good test takers, but and even that they find that doesn't correlate with other things.
No.
Except maybe other tests of the same sort, and maybe not. But the if you want to be look at things like you say, like success in life, the tests don't predict that. They don't even predict good teaching. You can't.
And children are such great teachers. And so
when
they teach each other, it's just it's such a joy to watch. Especially when younger ones teach older ones.
Uh-huh.
That is a beautiful thing to watch too. But I know that I had such fun getting ready for this interview because I knew you from your book, but there was a lot of research that I had to do, and I had a lot of fun, and I was so glad that I was getting to do something that I loved.
Oh yes.
You know, and it's that kind of thing. I think that once a child is turned on to learning and loves learning, you can't stop them. I know, my own took 5 years in undergraduate just because they weren't going to give up music because they were in biology, or they weren't going to give up music just because they were in dance and English, you know, because they, this was fun. This was, you know, this was feeding them, their soul.
Yes.
And when a child gets that kind of feeling, I mean, fixing cars, woodworking, all of that, you know, with a passion. It's
yes.
the passion for it that they're killing.
Yes.
In my opinion, when they're not going. I had a someone who did her teacher under teacher training with me, and she said, you know, Athena, even though they have given me a smaller class now, I have only 21 kids.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of 30, I can still not track each child in a process. I have to, it's because I have to, the product, you know, that test, that test.
Right, it's, you know, we learn so much, but just when we're around children, and they do teach us joy, and teach us how to look in wonder. And they do revive these qualities. I think Einstein said, what seemed to be remarkable about me, he said, is I think more like a young child.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great deal of testimony to this fact that the most creative people feel this affinity to childhood.
Yeah.
And, of course, if we want kids to be mediocre, we can keep going in the current course, and they will be unhappy memorizers.
Right, and they'll make good shoppers.
Well, yeah, and
and they won't even know they're in prison, kind of like Plato's cave.
They won't. They sense something's wrong. I think Harvard had programs where they teach kids, their students to take walks and try to create some spontaneity, because the students come to them such high achievers, but nervous wrecks that don't know how to relax and just observe, take a walk and observe things and let their minds go.
Right.
So they it's kind of an imprisoning force. The technology also pulls them away from their own selves and their own observations of the natural world. And
when it's too early.
Yeah, especially when it's. I think it's often too early.
Yes, it is often too early.
It locks them into a artificial.
Uses a babysitter kind of.
A mechanical world that's plastic and metal. It's a very impoverished ecologically the world of the technology of the computer. It's nothing like the there's no wind or sunshine or birdsong. There's no real ecology in the. In the world of the high-tech world of the video games and the computers, we have a real problem now. I hope it doesn't get too much down to childhood, that people are just practically, practically autistic, walking around the streets with their cell phones and their iPods. People are encapsulated in their own world. It's a problem.
It can be a problem. I'm hoping that. It's not going to be.
I hope
it's going to change.
I hope where you live that people are more alert to the natural.
Well, where we are, of course, is incredible nature.
Mm-hmm.
But it is amazing at how some people, even here, do not experience it. And so it's, anyway. Let's get back to Rhoda Kellogg for a minute.
Okay, sure.
I told the audience we would be talking about Rhoda.
Mm-hmm.
And she has written an amazing book called The Psychology of Children's Art. And she also talks so much about the child's creative power.
Yes.
And really shows you and illustrates through her book the child's strong creative power.
Yes. She was, I think, the pioneer in this area and mapped out the stages she thought were universal and showed that different cultures.
Right.
They were doing. They had different themes, but they were going through the same stages. And
when you talk about nature, I noticed in your book, in Explaining Childhood, you talk a lot about Roger Hart.
Yes. Hart did very good work. He followed kids around for his doctoral thesis when he was, I think, was a clerk in the early 70s. He went to a town in Vermont, rural Vermont, and followed children around and asked them to show him their favorite places. And it was kind of a naturalistic study. It wasn't too formal. He did put numbers on it in order to get it past his dissertation committee, I guess. But he was one of the first to observe this this feeling that kids can get around water, particularly that they sit by water and dabble, and they start to feel this kind of fluid connection. They go into a daydreamy state. I've seen it a lot myself with kids get into a kind of daydreamy state where I think they feel a oneness with the water in the world at these times. Adult autobiographies confirm this, that very creative people feel a sense of remembering their childhood years.
Yes, I do.
A sense of a very deep connection. Water is particularly good if you can have ponds and
right.
be near bodies of water.
Well, we had water slides and mud puddles.
Uh-huh.
And of course, the beach.
Yeah, the beach and the mud. There's other ways of experiencing it. But Hart was he didn't shy away from this. He saw this, and he also documented the amount of hideout building and the amount of creative building and how much trees, for example, meant to children. Mm-hmm. Some of the experiences mattered a lot, and it was I have that. I Xeroxed that whole, before it came out of the book at all, I Xeroxed page after page of it and bound it and referred to it a lot. It's one of the few studies where just a lot of very good observation of children in the natural world. And then he, one of his friends, he's from England, one of his friends, Robin Moore, at Berkeley took up a, with the community, they took up a play, an asphalt playground, at least part of it, and created a nature center and watched how the children changed when they had a nature area to play in.
Yeah.
And then you saw their senses come alive, and you saw their creativity come alive, and you saw this feeling of some kind of empathy with
nature.
With nature. And you saw some of the things that, that I've been talking about, and some of the things that Hart observed. And
anyone who's really interested, you go into it so well in Reclaiming Childhood. I just can't recommend that book enough.
Well, thank you.
Reclaiming Childhood.
Yeah, it draws on some of these works that I felt were particularly inspirational, particularly good. And you can see the difference in the children. I mean, on the blacktop, they were fighting, they were bored. Just the amount of aggression and fighting was down. In the nature area, they felt calm. They talked about the nature area like it was a soothing mother and make kids feel good about each other. And the kids said, you know, we start fighting, but then we go into the nature area and we feel relaxed and we like each other again.
I'm enjoying this so much in my life, this watching.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't even gotten halfway through all the things I wanted to talk to you about. This is just like such a dream for me to be talking to you on the phone.
Well, it's a pleasure for me.
And I wish we could have you back, because I know I'm going to get all kinds of questions, which I'm going to ask people to email me.
great.
And so maybe we can have you back. Do you think that'd be possible?
Oh, I'd love to come back.
Oh, thank you. You know, I was, you know, I had this question that a teacher had asked me about, you know, are we, as a teacher, are we to be an extension to of the family, or are we to just teach the kids how to read, write, and do math? And I thought, well, from everything you've said, I'm sure that you feel that we are more an extension of the family.
Absolutely.
And then about how important movement is.
Yes.
And all of these things, and we just didn't get there.
Yes.
But, oh, thank you so much, Bill, and thank your family. And I just thank the memory of Joy for making this possible.
You feel special, and it's been a special interview for me. It's great to talk to someone who understands and loves children. It's very special to be able to do that.
Well, you know, Bill, you're doing so much, and I thank you, and I know that all, for all the children, I thank you.
Okay.
And I'm going to be back.
Okay, I'd love to come back.
Good night, Bill.
Good night.
Well, everybody, next month, I want to just thank Bill so much. That was so much fun for me. And if you have questions, I'd like you to email me at Hermes, that's H-E-R-M-E-S, at pacific.net. And I'll be glad to answer your questions and maybe even bring them on the air with me the next time. Next month, that's April 20th, the third Thursday, Education Now will welcome Alfie Cohen, author of the bestseller Unconditional Parenting. Alfie is also a signer or a signature of the Alliance for Childhood. If you want information on my own work, you can find me on the web at Pacific Sites, that's pacificsites.com/TildaHermes. And if you didn't get that, then you can email me at hermes@pacific.net and I'll tell you again. Education Now was brought to you tonight by our members and Fabric Indulgence. Fabric Indulgence and Art Supply at 544 South Main Street in Fort Bragg. I want to thank Beth Lang, Mary Eigner, Loretta Hoke, Burton Siegel, Fred Woolley, and all the staff at X&Z. Thank you to you, our listeners, and our underwriters. If you'd like a copy of tonight's show, we have recorded it. You can email me again at hermes@pacific.net, and I'll be happy to see that you get a copy. Willett Center for the Arts is presenting their 14th annual art show. There will be a gala opening on Saturday, March 18th from 7 to 9 p.m. Information at 459-1732. There's going to be a rally and peace march on Saturday, March 18th at the Alex Thomas Plaza. It's a peace rally and march starting at 10 a.m. They'll be drumming before the rally at 9:45. You can bring your own signs to carry down Perkins Street beginning at 11 a.m. This event marks the third anniversary of the U.S. war in Iraq. People from all over the world will be marching and protesting on the same day. Good night, everyone. Stay tuned for Reality Check. Good night now.
This is Earth and Sky on how water is fundamentally different from other natural resources.
When you burn a piece of coal, it's gone. But water down the drain isn't consumed in the ordinary sense.